This is an interview with Miss Bernice Lowe, well-known Battle Creek historian. She is the author of the book, Tales of Battle Creek.
Okay, Mrs. Lowe, how did the people cope with the times and money and things from the Depression?
Actually, I didn't have a good view of the overall city. I was pretty much tied up at home with youngsters, and I was unable to do any community work at the first part of the Depression. Many of them were very much shocked. It didn't shock us as much as it did a lot of people, because they had been rich through the 20s, comparatively rich, rich in comparison to the average person before World War I. However, it was shock to them because they had money. We often think of the country club crowd. There were lots of them who had joined the country club. And when we came here in 1929, full of ourselves as well as debt, we couldn't do things of that sort. It didn't bother us because we had been in college and had been getting along on less than Johnny got, what was it, a penny a day because he couldn't work any faster? Well, that was our situation. So we had less adjustment to make than they did. We often laugh and say, oh, well, the Depression was just eating more beans. Well, actually, we had pretty good balanced meals. We would manage an orange a day for our little girl and things that we felt were very important. We had managed in college, so we kept on managing them fairly well. I can remember at the close of the Depression, that would be along about 37 or 38, I walked in a produce store that was downtown at the time, a very popular one, beautiful produce they had, considering the kinds of shipment. We didn't have air shipment at that time. And I saw my father-in-law, and he paid 8 cents a piece for grapefruit. And I kidded him for being so terribly indulgent. And he took me a little seriously, and he said, well, I'm going to have what I want, and I want some of these nice big grapefruit. But it's hard to compare prices today with prices at that time. It means that most of us were paying 4 cents a piece for grapefruit instead of 8 cents, and that difference in just a few cents was practically appalling, just the way it is now, that you pay a dollar and a half a pound for fairly common beef and practically $3 a pound for lamb. And this is shocking, you see, to the shopper. But I must tell you one story. In World War II, a woman who did some sewing for me, in fact, she made a good many of my clothes, had a son who was in the service during the war, and he had been sent to Alaska, and she had no idea where he would be sent from there. She had no idea how serious it might be in Alaska. No one knew what was going to happen during World War II. And one of her friends or customers or acquaintances said, well, who was working at one of the industries here that were just going strong and gave jobs to everybody. And she said, well, if I had my choice, I would have wars in place of depressions. And this bothered my seamstress very much to think that she would prefer being without money and letting my friend, the little seamstress son, be in a hazardous position. That didn't seem to bother the greedy person who was happy to have a good salary. But that remark shows that people really suffered during the Depression. Many of them couldn't have proper housing. they moved in together. Awful lot of families became cross at each other because they couldn't endure being under one roof. But there would be maybe two sons and their wives come home to live because they had no other place to go. And then they would just all try to pitch in and do something so as to get something to eat. When we moved out here to Gogwak Lake in 1940, the Depression was supposedly over, but there were still people who were unskilled and tried to get jobs. And there was an old man who lived in a flop house downtown who seemed very nice and certainly worked like a major and was very charming. I didn't have him in the house ever, but he and I worked in the garden together, and all he wanted was 25 cents an hour. And we worked hard on the hillside. But he was grateful for anything that would pay his way at this flop house, you see, and perhaps a meal at the mission for free or almost free at the end of the day. So there were many people, doubtless, who suffered greatly, and we used to see in the magazines pictures of long lines of men waiting for just one free meal. And there was continuous joke about the apple seller, and it wasn't a joke at all. It meant that men who had had fair laborers, who had fairly decent salaries, livable salaries, simply bought apples and sold an apple on the corner to make a few cents, 2 or 3 cents, and then would go back and buy another apple and come back and sell that apple on the street corner.
You would see that in Battle Creek?
No, yeah. I never saw that in Battle Creek. Mm-hmm. There were people who had certain corners. There's one woman who is still remembered, and it is believed that she did not suffer, that she just liked the way of life, that she wasn't as poor as she appeared to be. And she used to sell Hershey bars, and she would take newspapers with her and put them on the sidewalk so that her feet wouldn't get cold. And then she had rather thin galoshes, not the thicky kind that we have now, but they were just rubber-type boots up above the ankle. She had those, and she had what appeared to be a fairly thin coat, and she seemed also to be thin. But she was there year in and year out in front of Robinson's store, never asking anybody for anything. Oftentimes, amputees were seen visiting town. They were mostly trenches, and then they would come in town, and really they were beggars. They would have pencils to sell. You wouldn't want one of these pencils, so you'd just drop a nickel in the hat, and that's the way he existed. Then there was a man who sold, his name was, I think it was Watkins, or Watkins, and people became very fond of him. And he had been on evil days, not only financially, but he had had some kind of an illness that had impaired his working ability. And he sold newspapers in front of the Michigan National Bank. And when he died, the house organ out at Kellogg's wrote a very beautiful, beautiful tribute to this man. Oh yes, he was blind. He had become blind. And so they called him Blind Watkins, but said what a grand man he was. These are pictures, though, that are the same throughout the last century. People of this same sort had no recall to help from the government. There was no such thing as payment of Social Security. The elderly had nothing at all from the government. And so this is all new middle 20th century development, this help that the elderly and the ill are getting nowadays. But as for the Depression, no, we didn't have that kind of begging on the street. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there must have been plenty of people who went to the two places called the Mission and the Salvation Army Home or something of that sort downtown, but it was a type of flop house, and then there were several houses, I'm sure, several upstairs places that simply turned into spots for men, and they would have just an army cot and a blanket, be supplied an army cot and a blanket so they could sleep there for 10 cents. And this was a combination of people who wanted to earn a cent or two on the men each night. It didn't cost them that much, but they were not greedy. It was their kind of charity at the same time that they were earning their own way. Interesting other house, how the other half lives sort of thing.
With the depression and the shortage of money, how did the people really, how did they pay their bills when they...
Oh, they didn't.
They didn't?
Oh, many people were deep in debt. Mm-hmm. Now, my husband was a doctor, and there were, and of course a new one, in 1929. By 1932 and 33, he had built up a very large practice. He had to start as a general practitioner and then began specializing in his own fields gradually. But, of course, he did not have elegant offices. He had adequate offices in a downtown building, presentable, not a lot of room. But I remember one very amusing experience. It's amusing now. But one week, he and his nurse collected not 1 cent. There wasn't, they had plenty to do, and he had to buy gas for his car, probably at 16 or 18 cents a gallon. And because I know we were not paying 25 cents a gallon until much, much, much later than that. And cars cost $400 and $500 a piece. That is a little Ford to get around. And although the A model came out just about at the beginning of the Depression, not everybody was driving a T model anymore, but a car that looked more like today's cars. But still, they were very, very inexpensive. And but he didn't collect a cent. And a man came in, and he was drunk. And this was a Saturday afternoon. They kept offices open sometimes Saturday nights. There were some doctors who did. But this was a Saturday afternoon at the end of the week. And he was quite drunk, and he just was able to tell Dr. Lowe that he wanted something to sober him up. Well, one of the ways of sobering up an alcoholic, as I understand it, was to give rather potent drug. Nowadays, you'd say he was being drugged. Well, as I recall, Dr. Lowe did not use any narcotic, but he must have known something else anyway. I don't know whether he gave him something to curb his appetite or what it was, but at the end of the experience, he said, "Well, I'll just do anything because I don't know where I'm going. I'm just not able to think at all." And so, as he walked through the office, the nurse spoke to Dr. Lowe and said, "How much shall I charge him?" Well, ordinarily, you would have charged a person for an office call $1.50 or something like that. But she had to be paid, and she made $15 a week. And she said to the man, "We'd like to have you pay for this call." And he took a purse, a billfold, out of his pocket and threw it on her desk and said, "Take what it's supposed to be." And there were a lot of bills in the purse. Now, whether he had gambled or stolen or what, nobody knows. Everything was in a state of confusion financially. And Stan looked at her, my husband looked at her and said, take out your salary. And she took $15 from that purse. I think that's the only time he ever overcharged anybody. But the man didn't know. He might have lost the $15 to a thief and to a pickpocket in no time at all. And so that's how his nurse was paid that week, but we were paid nothing. We had nothing to live on if we had been dependent on that. But my husband has always been very saving, and the day he started practice, he started a bank on his desk, and he dropped 50 cents in that bank every morning before he started work. And that always was there in reserve. So we didn't suffer the way a lot of people did. But we had lots and lots of ways of cutting down on costs. Oatmeal porridge, Johnny cake, other things made with cornmeal. Beans that you soaked were very cheap. And even fresh produce was often very cheap and not bad in season. We didn't get much in the wintertime, but we would, of course, relish dandelion greens as soon as they came up in the spring. And you know how many dandelions there are. And this is a recipe that's just very much loved in my family. I can remember my grandmother's waiting for the dandelions to be just big enough to cut for greens as long before they begin to blossom. And of course they're very, very tasty. And there were other things. There were root edibles and roadside things that were edible. People in the 19th century used to go nutting, and that was for black walnuts along the roadside, because many people had planted black walnuts at a fence row, and then all of the walnuts that fell on the roadside were for the public, and it was perfectly all right to go nutting, and we would have good food that way. And of course there were other nuts. As a child, I remember very much going in the woods and eating, in the early spring, eating beech nuts that had fallen the fall before, and they'd cracked open. And because they cracked open, there were little flat-sided inner shells that were quite thin, and you could tear open those shells, and the meat inside was very, very good. And then we used to chew wintergreen leaves. And if there are any berries, of course, we ate them. Wintergreen berries, lush. When you don't have money, nature always has something to offer you if you're alert. And it's rather fun. And people used to plant the kind of onions that you separate in the spring and plant again, so you have the early green onions. And I can remember gathering sets of onions so that we'd have them in the spring. When I was a kid, this was before the Depression. But of course, this is what saved people during the Depression. But the bad part of the Depression was not actually in Michigan. The worst of it was in the dust storm area in the West. Those dust storms and the dryness hit at the same time that the Depression hit. In the early and mid-30s, and the people in the Dakotas just suffered. Everybody had nothing that lived. You couldn't borrow from your neighbors, it wasn't this family that suffered, it was just everybody in the area. And I had a friend who was a librarian here, and she mentioned a woman that was a teacher when she had taught up in the Dakotas. And she said her children, she had written this letter to my friend saying that that it was just impossible to get any money for anything, and I don't know if we're going to starve or what. And she said, nor clothe the children. Well, now this would be a natural thing to write. And I said, oh, how would you like to have me gather some clothes for these little girls? How old would they be? And she told me. And I had a little girl that was a little older than, as I recall, her oldest one or something, like three little girls. And I gathered all of the clothes around the house that we could possibly get along without, that had been outgrown. And I had some friends, and I said, I'm making up a box, wouldn't you like to? We got some things you'd like to send. And then our librarian friend paid the postage on it and sent it. And the woman who received the box talked about answers to prayers. And you know, it never occurred to me she was praying for clothes and that I would be delegated to answer a prayer. And I was so pleased to think that that was God's way, and that he would be bothering to use my thoughtfulness to answer her prayers. And it was quite an education. I think that going through something like the Depression works out as an education. You don't become more self-centered. You become less greedy. You'd think you'd become more greedy because you'd want something for yourself. That isn't the way it works.
Everyone seemed to help everybody out.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I don't look back on the Depression as a horrible thing. And I think now with these daily blows from the inflation, the prices of things, we've always had, because we've gone through school without money and without much money, and through the Depression and through a couple of wars and that sort of thing, when we had to get along without, we've had a lot of schooling in frugality. And it's easy for us to be frugal, easier than it is for us to spend, if you'd really like to know. We're reticent about writing checks to this thing, that thing, and the other that comes begging, because these organizations seem greedy to us. And letters that come in the mail that ask for things for the Indians and the poor boys and this, that, and the other. we can't send money to them because we know too many people, among relatives who are hitting difficulties of one type or another. Everybody has setbacks, and if you can help your own, I think that's your first obligation, is to take care of your own. But we're very reticent about just throwing any money that we might have around. You remember there's an old proverb called, them has gets. Have you ever heard that?
No.
Well, it's true. It's true that people who have money because they've saved, manage to invest it, and it grows. But those who spend it every week never get ahead. So them as gets. Mm-hmm. Old Yankee proverb. I don't know as I've told you much about the Depression. One of the interesting things that I recall is that there seemed to be plenty of stuff to buy. I bought dresses that I can remember from my 10-year-old. She would have been 10 years old in 1932. Well, I bought dresses all the way from $1 to 2.5 a piece. Pretty little things, nice, almost nicely made. And there was plenty of that sort of thing in the stores, and the stores were glad to sell. Nowadays, with this inflation, we find that it's hard to find things. We constantly are complaining about the fact that we go and there's only four or five of something in the store, when you'd expect the shelves to be just absolutely loaded. Well, they're so high that the storekeeper can't afford to stock the shelves heavily in case there might be a loss. If there were a quick recession, then that stuff wouldn't move at all. So it's kind of a vicious circle working the other way. During the Depression, we had all kinds of stuff. If we had a dollar, we could buy a dress for a little girl. And that was that. Or we could buy material at 35 cents a yard and make it. And most of us could. And I remember when we were in college that and had a washing machine, which was quite an indulgence, but I'd had it before we went back to school, so I took it with me. And we had a basement room in which to wash. We took care of an apartment house, and the basement of that apartment house had tubs and so on, so that I could use the washing machine. Well, you didn't wash every day. You had to have a lot of clothes. And a little girl could have, well, I remember counting up one day how many changes of clothing she had, and it was 14. Well, that's not too much for a toddler. And the reason I could was because I could buy material for from 15 to 35 cents a yard. And there was one little pattern that I had for a dress of hers that I could get out of a yard and a half of material. And it was cute as a bug. My mother sent me the pattern. In fact, my mother sent me a dress that she had made, and I liked it so much that I made several of these little dresses. And little girls didn't wear pants in those days. They wore, in the wintertime, they wore long stockings. And I made these dresses, and they cost practically nothing. And I made, which would be the same as the Depression, I had the heavy dress that I had for the winter in my trousseau. I still had the dress. When Marjorie was a toddler, well, that'd be 6 or 7 years later. And it was a heavy, man-suiting type material, quite attractive in a light gray. And I had embroidered it with a Chinese design, and it was very swish, very swish. And I loved wearing it and that sort of thing. Well, I took out all of the embroidery, and we didn't send stuff to the cleaners then. We used to sponge it and press it and do that sort of thing, get it clean. So I took this dress and made my daughter a coat and a bonnet and lined it. And my mother-in-law gave me a little piece of, she saw what I was doing, and she said, oh, I have a little piece of squirrel. And it was squirrel fur. I think the leather part was about an inch wide. It was quite a long piece. So I had enough for around the collar, around the cuff, and around the bonnet. And oh, it was a lovely little coat. And of course I used leftover linings and things from other things to line the coat and the bonnet and put in a little padding, and that was not expensive in those days. So I'm sure that many women did very much the same thing during the Depression, because those people who were frugal and had taught themselves to sew and to cope with all kinds of emergencies, they got along just fine. I really think they did.
What were the prices of things? Were there a lot of things that nobody could afford?
No. I wouldn't think so. No, everything was, of course, everybody didn't have a car. But then it wasn't yet the thing to do to have a car. You see, children walked 2 miles to school and thought nothing of it. We lived up on Sherman Road, and our son, at the end, long in the Depression, we moved to Sherman Road, and our son went to 3 months school, so that he had about 4 or 5 blocks to walk. And our daughter went to Central and to the junior high, and which was just across the road, or on the same property or something.
And we thought nothing of it. And those youngsters walked home for lunch. Nobody took a lunch, except the children from the country who had to come a great distance. And, or if they lived more than 2 miles from school, they didn't think anything about walking to school. Walking home for lunch, eating a bite, and going back to school. Nice hot lunch, and you know, it was fun to walk. You know, be outdoors. They did that instead of playing on the playground.
Were there a lot of people unemployed in Battle Creek? Were there people who didn't have anything to do?
This would be true every place. And that's what I meant by this man who worked for 25 cents and lived in the flop house. He had no skills. And there were lots of people who were willing to work in yards and do work of that sort. My husband had one family that had several children. Of course, they never paid a bill, and always. He would come to the house and help me with the spring cleaning. And those were the days when you took the rugs outdoors and hung them on the line and hit them with a carpet beater and that sort of thing, because our vacuum cleaners were not very efficient. I had a vacuum cleaner during the war, during the depression, I know that. I don't think it was a very efficient one. But he would come and carry things in and out for me, clean the basement windows and do things like that. And we'd give him either credit, well, we'd give him credit always, as I remember. And then if I had anything extra in the house, like a chair that I didn't need, I bought a secondhand table one time that was linked, that lengthened out. That was before we got this one, which also lengthens out. And but this was just an oak table, and I think I paid $5 for it. That somebody now would consider an antique and would pay a very fancy price for it. Had carved legs and so on. Commercially carved, but not hand carved, but a rather attractive table, and it would seat a large family. I think we had no difficulty in getting 12 people around this table. Well, it was in the basement, and he came to me and said, "Mrs. Lowe, could I buy that table of you?" And I said, "Well, Mr. So-and-so, I know that you're never going to have the money to pay for it, so I'll be glad to give it to you." And of course he took it, and then I gave him credit for his bill besides. But you weren't greedy during the war, you weren't greedy during the war either, but you weren't greedy during the Depression. It just didn't fit in somehow. If somebody needed something that you had that was superfluous, you gave it away. And there are many people now who say to their parents, "Well, why didn't you save that?" Well, you didn't save it because somebody could use it. You just wouldn't have it around. And there were people who lived in old houses who were surrounded by family things, and they wouldn't part with them. Now those houses are turning into museums, and they're much sought after. But in the Depression, those people, we probably would have said, "Well, that old Biddy won't give anything away now. She has a lot of things that could be used by this family and this family and this family, but she will not part with anything." Well, it's very nice that those are museums now, are selling at high prices. But I think I prefer the other way. No, I can't say that. I felt that the war was much, much worse than the Depression. But as I quoted, there were people who said, "I'd rather go through a war than a Depression."
Mm-hmm. What was the centennial celebration like in Battle Creek?
That was tremendous. Mr. Brigham, who was in the Kingman Museum and had just been placed there, they had just been given the Kingman Museum, and they had room at that time for quite a few things. And he and his son
And the Historical Society together decided that it would be great to put on this tremendous centennial. And there, it lasted practically all week. And there was a pioneer village off Columbia Avenue down here. Do you remember where there's a practice down here on Columbia Avenue? At the right, there used to be a little golf place that where people could rent up bag of balls. And well, that's the area, and they had to, and people who wanted to visit had to enter from that the road beyond. But anyway, it was east of this area, and they could come in, and cabins had been built of different eras, and I mean different styles of pioneer life. The school and the way to make maple syrup and how to make sorghum molasses and how to use candle molds and how to dip candles, and they had all of these demonstrations, such as nowadays are at Greenfield Village and occasionally Kimball House. But this was all set up specially for that week. And then there was a parade beyond belief, giving the whole history of the last century. And they even had streetcar tracks here then. They even had an old engine that came down the street in the parade. And you could do that because of having the streetcar track. And it went past McGamley Park and down through the middle of town where the mall is now. And it was a tremendous thing. And they borrowed oxen, a yoke of oxen from all over, and had many, many of the wagons drawn by oxen, some by big horses. It really was an educational demonstration. And there are lots of pictures of it. And one of the news companies sent one of their crews here to get pictures. I don't remember which one it, definitely which one it was, but one of the news companies, movie companies. You see, in the movies, they used to show news along with a feature movie. Always you had a few minutes of news, and that was fresh every week, so that there were news crews going all over the country. That was before the days of television. Now, we had radios at that time, but no television.
Did people listen to the radio a lot for all the news?
Lots of people didn't have radios by 1930, but by 1935, then there were second-hand radios available, and so that people who could afford a new one got another new one, something bigger and better, an Atwater Kent perhaps, and then had an old one that they would sell, and the people who couldn't afford a new one would pick these old ones up. You know, there were some that were like a cathedral door. You've seen those.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the first ones I remember. The very first one I remember was long before the Depression. In 1924, my husband built a radio, and this was not uncommon. And we had just a panel, the front, and all of the gadget part of it was behind the panel. Well, the condenser was made up of several little panels of metal. And sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. And if it needed another condenser, we very quickly discovered that a flat hand put against it would create another condenser and make it louder so that we could hear it. And there were only a few stations we could get, a station in Chicago, one in Pittsburgh, and you know, like that. And but we could get them. And well, you couldn't sit there forever with your hand this way. So when I was doing the mending of an evening, or my husband was fussing with something or wanted to listen to music, and if there was a music program on and he wanted to read, why, he would do the same thing. We'd sit back in a chair and put our feet up in front of it, and the feet would act as another condenser. But those were pre-Depression days. It really isn't a relevant story.
How did Battle Creek pay for that centennial celebration? How could it afford to put it on if it was...
Well, I can't imagine. I really can't imagine. I think each person contributed so much. The men went out in the fields, out in the woods where they were allowed to cut down trees, all volunteer labor, on Sundays, and there are pictures of them cutting down trees and dragging them to this place where the pioneer village was going to be. And then there were men who could make mortar out of clay, and you didn't have to buy any cement because there wasn't any cement back in pioneer days. You built it according to the way the pioneers had to build their places. And there is clay in this area, so they probably had no difficulty in rounding that up. And they would just take wagons, borrow wagons, and I really think the Historical Society did most of it. Now, there must have been some expense in the way of writing letters, and I don't know how that was paid for. Maybe the Historical Society did pay that. But I presume this was a parade that today would cost $1.5 million, and I would imagine it was put on for around $500. I don't know. Just because everybody who had something loaned it. And that was it. It was cataloging. All of these things had to be done, but they were all done by volunteers. Mm-hmm. No, if you're going to do something, well, you just went ahead and did it. You didn't ask for a lot of money to back it up. Nowadays, if somebody has a bright and brilliant brainstorm, he has to have $2,000 or $3,000 before he can commence to start. And he goes out in the highways and byways and gets the money. But now, you just got along. And I can remember when a pad of paper like that you're writing on would cost never more than a dime, maybe 2 for 15 cents. Composition books in school when I was a little girl would be that thick, have that much paper in them, and they cost a nickel. And a slate, which you could wipe off and use over and over again in place of scratch paper, you used a slate, and a slate pencil was a penny, and a slate would be 25 or 35 cents. And you had one slate all your life. You were careful of it. You tried awfully hard not to drop it. But if you dropped it, it would drop on the soil and not on the cement, because there wasn't any cement. You walked to school where there weren't any sidewalks, you see. That's the way you got along. Yeah. And when I was a little girl, most of my friend and I had blackboards, and they were portable. You just folded up like an easel. And then you just get out the blackboard out of a closet and set it up. And then you use chalk on this little blackboard that was 20 by 24 inches, probably. And you did your drawing on it, or you did your lettering, or you did your arithmetic lesson, and you walked it out. You didn't throw it in the wastebasket. It wasn't near the amount of trash that there is today. We didn't begin to burn things the way we do. Now look, this shows how I've been brought up by having been born in the 19th century and brought up before people began to spend money. I don't throw a piece of paper like that away that's done on one side. I tear it up, put a clip on it, and it's beside my phone. All of my Christmas cards are taken apart. The pretty ones
are saved to give away, the pretty parts. Children can use them. They use them in nursing homes. The campfire people make pretty things out of them and so on. All of those that have messages on them. Unless they're on both sides, I use the back of that Christmas card, and that's my scratch paper. And here it is, April, and I still have some on this kitchen table, and I have some beside my desk.
Since you had kids in school during the time, what was the education system like in the schools?
Well, it was the beginning of the so-called modern way of teaching. Earlier in the century, in the teens, before the First World War, there was a one school system that was very modern, and that was in Gary, Indiana. And that, in that school system, the teachers did not make the children stand in line after recess or noon hour in order to come into the building, or stand in line to leave at night. They just let them wander. And this was considered pretty bad, pretty bad.
Mrs. Dudley instigated this and inspired some of her teachers very much. Well, our daughter Marjorie was in the room of a woman by the name of Irene Isley, who was absolutely entranced by this opportunity of letting the children be creative. And while she was in fifth grade, and Sharon Marjorie wrote some very decent verse, and the children put on a historical play that they themselves had written. And I remember that because Miss Isley asked me to come and tell these children how to write a play. Well, all I could do was to tell them about ascending action, that there would have to be a climax here, and a quickly falling action, and they have to have at the end of what would be the first act an indication of what's going to happen the rest of the play, and how to have episodes and how many episodes they really ought to have that seemed to have a little climax of their own, just an episode that would sort of stand out by itself. Wasn't much else I could tell them, and I wasn't sure they caught on to it, and they did a beautiful play about the Magna Carta, and then they put it on with costumes and a coat of mail for the King John. I've forgotten whether it was made out of bottle tops or what the heck it was made out of, but it certainly looked like a coat of mail and a sort of a smock type thing. And it beat all the t-shirts today, all hollow. But these youngsters were inspired to do these things. And I will say that there was a lot of experimentation going on. It was very constructive during the years of the Depression. A little later, I think it went too far out. And that's what they're trying to come back from now, when they say get back to basics and got to have grammar and they can't add two and two, and they can only add up to 10 and all that kind of stuff. It's actually, as I look at the Battle Creek school system from this viewpoint 40 years later, I would say that it was tops, that it was very, very good, that they had already absorbed those things that we consider modern, the new way of doing things, that is, the more casual way of doing things, and the stimulation of the children to do creative things was great. Now, those were the days when you could still trust people. You didn't have the terror on the streets and the
awful things that are happening now. If there was one in the country, it didn't cause an epidemic the way it does now. You know, this week mm-hmm. there was violence in two or three parts of town, and the newspaper blamed it onto a television program, because it said show them just exactly how to do it, and so that's what was done here in town. And I feel that it was an easier age for the educators, very much easier. There were not those pressures. Now there are the pressures of, there was a program this morning. I think it was on the Today program. I believe it was this morning. And it showed how the teachers must take any of the handicapped if they want to come, if the parents want to send them to that school. Well, now that's going to cut down the quality of the education considerably. How can you take the time to teach this child the basics, which would take all day for one person? A person to person, it ought to be, almost. How can you take the time to ask your children to write poetry?